It was interesting what you just said at the end there, because I was thinking through much of the talk. Do you think a lot of the sort of social perturbation around this could be resolved by utterly separating state and religious marriages and saying that you cannot perhaps be married in Syria? If you want to long-term link yourself to another person for the legal and tax benefits, call that something else, like a civil compact maybe, and that marriage can only happen in a religious setting, and therefore the churches are free to marry whoever they want to because the legal benefits are put somewhere else.
It's certainly a view, but it's extremely complicated. And it's extremely complicated because of where our marriage law comes from and our histories. And I like to think in these things that actually when we're thinking about marriage and problems with marriage and marriage law, that you either blame Henry VIII or you blame the Victorians, and because between them, basically everything that I have an issue with is sort of embraced within that. And certainly the church and state thing is a big issue in that. And one of the reasons, of course, that Anglican churches at this moment are separated from this new law is because of canon law and the way that it interacts with state law. Certainly it was the view of those in the Reformation that it should be separated. Luther said that, which is why in Europe, in the majority of Europe, that's exactly what happens. You have a legal contract in the town hall and then a blessing in the church, if that's what you want to do. It doesn't necessarily remove the questions that there are around the blessing of same-sex partnerships, of course, because it still brings that challenge to the church, whether it's a legal thing or not. But it is certainly true that there is a difference between the percentage of people who would say that same-sex relationships are not wrong, so that would be accepting, affirming even as same-sex relationships, but still have a problem with marriage, because same-sex marriage is seen to be something quite different. And this thing of who owns the institution of marriage is something that's quite complicated. A state or the church, ordained by God, or something within society. And of course, that's where it gets very complicated, because some of our traditions and laws and things just only go back a generation or two, actually. And this thing of marrying for love and the not seeing a woman as a transfer of property and all of these things, all of that stuff that's within so many of the traditions that we continue to operate today without realising what it is that we're doing, perhaps. So it's very complicated.
Is what you just said about, you know, marriage ordained by God or something of society, isn't that a false dichotomy? Because it can be ordained by God but still be a societal practice, and it goes beyond church to most cultures.
That's
and
right.
Faith and non-faith issues.
Indeed, and it's where, again, I'm no anthropologist either, but I think it'd be true to say that every society has something akin to marriage in one way or another in terms of its formation. And that's where the sort of ordained by God, the Genesis stuff comes as the foundation for marriage and man and a woman and complementarity and all of that stuff. What I'm addressing in terms of whether it's a societal value and change or whether it's a church thing, I think comes in the way in which that is expressed. I suppose I've been challenged often by folk who seem to think that the marriage law as we have it in this country at this moment is exactly the same as it was in Genesis, and that there's been no change at all as it's gone through, because there's a very simplistic view that tends to suggest that, where actually the facts are very, very different from that, and it's always been changing. If you have any sleepless nights and you want to download the marriage bill or the marriage act, you will see just how complicated that is and convoluted it is, because in effect it's come together over a number of years. And I think one of the things the government found, or particularly the civil service, when they tried to enact what the government wanted, was just actually it wasn't possible to do it in the way in which they first thought that it was, because of all the legal complications. It's like one of those buildings that's had little bits added onto it here and there all over the place, And it's a nightmare, really, in those terms.
We're talking about this revolution in culture. And I just wonder what your views are on the fact that, and you also talked about it being missional. We want, how can we be missional in this culture? We don't want to lose that. Now, my view is culture driving faith, or is faith, should faith be driving culture? Yeah. In other words, are we going to redact our faith in order to fit in with culture?
A key missional question, of course, and is one that we have always struggled with, and we continue to engage with that. And I think it's, in one sense, it's both. But you need to be careful when you hear me say that, because I certainly do not mean that our faith should be driven by society and culture, and that's one of the reasons why I say we need to look at this: is this good, or and that needs to be tested. But it certainly would not be the first time that a change in society has challenged the way that church has behaved, and you can trip off the usual ones of slavery, of the treatment of women, apartheid, and so on. You know, but there are many occasions where there have been challenges, I think, from wider society that have changed the way in which we have read scripture in the context of the mission of the pastoral thing that we are. So I don't want to say that we should be driven by outside, but I think we should be challenged by it and reflect on what then are our values that we bring to this biblically, because Bible-believing Christian, I want to see those things addressed. But we have always, there is always the challenge of interpretation of the hermeneutic that goes into that. So just one of the things that we need to hold in tension.
Of course, it could be pointed out that in the case of the three things you mentioned, there's always been Christians who opposed the wider view.
Absolutely.
And
often for what we might now say would be horrific things. I mean, the slaves in Jamaica, it was a case of if you let them go free, we're not going to have then the money to be able to continue the missions. And anyway, they're getting the gospel preached to them while they're there. So isn't that for their soul? So keep them. You know, all of those things which are horrific now as we hear them, but 200 years ago, we're actually a part of Christian witness.
And we're all the way through.
Yeah. And indeed, in our lifetimes, was true in South Africa.
Indeed.
The church's attitude to the black problem. It seems to me such a problem, such a pity of two coming together to constitute a contractual arrangement, just to boil it down to nuts and bolts. Two people of Christian faith who want to take those vows in church, in the sight of God, as it is said, and with the support of their Christian friends and family, can't do so. Because I think the support of the Christian congregation is vitally important, and I think that should be equally available to gay couples who will need every bit as much of support and loving care going forward as the traditional heterosexual couple.
And that's certainly one of the arguments that is made for the provision of some form of blessing, be it marriage or otherwise, in that the challenge is, if you're not going to provide a framework for that to be learned and supported, then who are you to challenge a sort of lifestyle within it if you dismiss it in that way? But I do think this question of, is this a lifestyle choice, or is it part of who we are, however complicated that might be, as fundamental then to how we address that as well? Because the traditional Christian response has been, it's something that can be changed. And that challenge, yeah, please.
What I was saying in my talk about the not conflating attraction with behaviour, self-identity or lifestyle is quite important here, because the rhetoric you hear in the US about being a lifestyle choice, they're talking about attraction. They think that people can choose to change their attraction often. But I'm not trying to dispute that the gay lifestyle that you mentioned, the sort of hedonistic, over-the-top, promiscuous, self-indulged, that's a choice. And it was a choice made by several people in the 70s and 80s, as you said, possibly in response to, you know, social trends and everything. But that shouldn't be conflated with the idea of personal choice in attraction, which, as I say, I think is poorly supported. But people who are gay certainly have a choice as to which lifestyle they then engage in.
Okay.
Stephen, would you like to comment on the numbers of gay people who are actually taking up same-sex marriage? Is it as popular as it was expected to be?
To be honest, I don't have at my fingertips the number that have taken it up. There was always going to be a blip, if you like, all those who had waited in that way. But one of the other things that I've certainly noted in conversations with gay Christians is a number who are in some form of civil partnership for contractual reasons, but who, as part of their understanding of Christian life, would not want to be involved in a marriage, even though they are committed and faithful in their relationship, because they would see marriage as being something different. So, equally so, there are those who would say the only way that you get the true equality is for it to be marriage and not this civil contracty thing. But I don't think it's been surprising, I think, how quiet that has been. Let me put it that way. How quiet that has been. I'm not sure of the exact numbers, but I don't think it's been as many as people had thought it was going to be.
The idea of an exclusive covenant relationship is not popular with a great many people in the gay scene.
Well,
at least in their younger days.
Yeah, you see, the evidence tends to suggest, and this is what surprised me in that thing, that although the sort of attitudes around sexuality and sexuality and so on now very clearly is you don't need to be married before you can begin to have sex, but the attitude that seems to be there in terms of the committed relationships appears to be more of a strengthening almost of that expectation and that bond. And I think that's as true with homosexual couples as it is with heterosexual couples. I only have anecdotal evidence, but yeah.
Is that not the case, do you think, that you said you were surprised by the finding that more people nowadays disapprove of cheating? But is that not because more and more in society people are using a moral framework from utilitarianism? So they judge moral actions by the harm caused, and they see cheating as harmful because it causes emotional pain to another person. So that means they're fine with homosexuality done consensually. They're fine with sex before marriage because, again, that's consensual and non-harmful. But when it becomes a harmful behaviour...
Yes.
So I think that's what may be driving those statistics.
I think that probably is true. The surprise for me was that I think the popular view would be that it would be the opposite to that, that the sort of promiscuity, even in relationship, is on the up, where these figures don't seem to support that at all.
If I could, I think the language is changing. I think promiscuity and cheating are not synonymous in
current dialogue.
And someone who is in an open relationship...
Yes.
Will not describe that as a cheating.
No, that's right.
And I think, again, even the dialogue, the words we're using about sexuality, we've hardly touched on transgender issues,
right.
which needs another language to talk about it.
Yes,
and
probably.
The first stages of articulating what we need to say. And actually, the community of society out there is a lot more savvy about what they want to say about relationships than I think we are. I think we're still using an old-fashioned language to debate a different societal perception.
That's true. Do you think that's right?
Questions?
Something you said, I think, is quite paradoxical in a way. We were told when the same-sex marriage bill was passing that it wouldn't change marriage for heterosexuals, but it has, because it's, you know, consummation and adultery are no longer, neither of those is now part of, well, consummation is not a part of marriage, adultery is not a reason for a marriage to be, you know, for divorce or anything like that.
And that's not true for heterosexual couples.
Oh, does that not apply?
No, no.
Okay, so
this is where the marriage law, it's like two parallel tracks.
Okay, so that's very interesting, because I thought that had changed the definition of marriage.
It's not my understanding that that's been the case.
Okay, but there is still the paradox is still there, because the idea was to, protect and sanctify in some way same-sex union, faithful same-sex unions. Well, of course, it's not doing that if those things have no meaning.
But this is where the complication of the law becomes, because of the way that the law defines that, in terms of consummation, because of the way that the law defines it in terms of adultery, you can't use those words within homosexual relationships. So it's not, doesn't feature in that bit of the act.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. I'm following on from that. I would argue that the church's role is vastly more important when it comes to same-sex relationships then. If by law they are homosexual couples aren't protected when they're married in terms of divorcing to do with adultery, then the church's responsibility, its social responsibility, is to ensure that faithful and committed monogamous homosexual relationships stay faithful, committed and monogamous as we feel that scripture dictates for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I think most of us would regret the clumsy and hasty way in which legislation was put together.
Yes.
But that, if we just park that, because most of us would want to redefine the word terminology, I think probably never will have an opportunity. Park that and just consider the pastoral aspects of church ministry. That doesn't stop churches hosting a genuine expression of lifelong commitment and supporting that going forwards. Whatever the theoretical objections, if churches are willing to take this leap, you know, they have a very important role going forward. And if we constantly quibble about terminology and want to go back and revise the law and so forth, I think we're missing great opportunity within our churches.
Okay, thank you. It is, yes, indeed, and I think they are questions that we need to take seriously, which is where I'm at. It's a very, it's a very difficult position to be in this way. I certainly do agree that the whole thing was rushed through, but I can say that from who I am and my context and everything. It was all rushed through. It was rushed through, I might say, personal opinion on a political thing, particularly to remove it as far as possible from May 2015, so that the voting public may well have forgotten about it by the time it gets there. But let's also be clear that it wouldn't have mattered which political party was actually in power at that stage. It would have happened, I think, in the lifetime of this parliament. So, and of course, it's part of a wider picture. A growing number, particularly of European, but of worldwide countries, it's about 18, I think now, 20 if you count some states and not others, but who have this as part of law. So there is a growing challenge, I think, to us about how we do it, and it comes back to this thing then about how much we're driven by societal change and how much our values and around biblical values and the practice of faith then, and it's bringing those in. I don't want to see them in tension, I want to see them in conversation, but at the same time that's not always a comfortable conversation, and there may well be moments at which the two cannot come together now.
just to say, we're going to be obviously touching more on the pastoral side of things that you brought up just now in the session this afternoon on the pastoral responses. But I'm interested to think about, with regards to the social side of things, something we've not yet touched on, but which seems to me to underlie it, is the link in society, which I think has broken down over the last 60 or 70 years, between marriage and the procreation act. And so if you have an understanding of marriage as being inherently linked to providing a context for the biological reproduction leading to children, then that gives marriage a particular definition within society. Things like the readily available contraception had started to break apart the link between sex and procreation, which then started to bring challenges to the notion of marriage as society defined it, as the place within which sex happened and children came into being. So you end up with sex becoming something that can be recreational rather than procreative.
Mm-hmm.
And that poses a challenge to marriage. So you then end up with the possibility of an intentionally childless heterosexual marriage, which is achieved through the use of contraception, being a new thing within society. That simply didn't exist before the introduction of readily available contraception.
Yeah.
And I think that there's something about that which paves the way for the current Same-Sex Marriage Act, because actually if you can have an intentionally childless coupling for a whole host of reasons that are not procreative, then you can open the way for that to occur in a same-sex way, just as it can do using contraception in a heterosexual way.
I think that is, it's certainly part of the wider context, and that's right to identify that. The other thing I think missionally and pastorally is that in the past, and it's past recent generations, but I think the church has been too focused on traditional nuclear family, if you like, as being the unit which is prized above all others. So actually, single folk find difficulty often within church community as well, because of the way that this is elevated as the only way. And childless couples, for whatever reason, choice or biology, also find themselves with particular challenges,
or just
within
elderly.
That. Or just elderly. Well, that's the other thing, of course, that there are, I've conducted a number of marriage services at which I've taken out the bits about procreation because it would have been completely inappropriate, having talked to the couple, of course. But doing marriage classes for 60 and 70 year olds is a bit different to how you might approach that for 20 year olds. But it is an issue.
Yeah, definitely.
Concern.